Welcome, everyone. It's good to be with you this evening. I'm excited to be talking with you about Genesis 37 and 38. We're going to see that God is trustworthy to accomplish His purposes, His good purposes, in everything that happens. You know, I don't know where you are right now, but where I am, I look around and I see craziness happening. Seems like everything's out of control. Every day, I see more news about things happening that just a few weeks ago seemed impossible. I wouldn't even have dreamed of them. I've learned new things, like working via Zoom or going to church via Zoom. I've learned new terms and what they mean, like social distancing and sheltering in place. And I've even been reminded that some of the old things that my mom taught me, like washing my hands, are very important. But as thousands of people around the globe are getting sick and dying, we're all forced to face our fears. And when we do that, we have to come to grips with what we truly believe. Some live in faith, knowing that God controls the beginning, the end, and that ours is to live each day doing the calling that He's given us. Some live in fear, not knowing what their future holds and trying desperately to hold on to and control everything they possibly can. Most of us live somewhere in between as God works in us and helps us to learn total dependence on Him. But I will tell you, there's good news, there's great news, that while everything around us seems out of control, we know that God is in control and that He's trustworthy to accomplish His good purposes. So far, Genesis has been the story of God creating the universe, and then He established the patriarchs of Israel. Through all of these stories, we've seen examples of faith, and we've seen examples of men making bad choices. Chapter 36 told us the story of Esau's family. Chapter 37, we start with the story of Jacob, and it shifts to the story of his family, into Joseph. And then in Genesis 38 is a story about Judah that's important. And then the rest of Genesis focuses on Joseph and Israel in Egypt. Today, as we look at Genesis 37 and 38, we're going to see a group of people whose situation seems out of control, like the one we're in today. Some of the people in the story trust God. Some try to control things for themselves. The story gets ugly, and it's filled with strife and conflict and a whole bunch of bad choices. But what's clear throughout the story is that God fulfills His promises. He is trustworthy to accomplish His purposes. And even when we can't see Him, He's still there, redeeming our life circumstances to achieve His purposes. So our divisions today are Genesis 37, that God is trustworthy in strife, and Genesis 38, that God is trustworthy in brokenness. Joseph's story is one of my favorite stories in the Bible. His life demonstrates God's sovereignty, His trustworthiness, His faithfulness, His provision, His willingness to redeem our circumstances for His glory, and a whole lot of other attributes. But in Genesis 37, we see that that inspiring story doesn't have an inspiring start. In verses 1 through 11, we see that God is trustworthy even when there's conflict. You know, conflict can happen any time in our lives in the way that we respond to the circumstances that we're in. This family's circumstances were challenging for sure, but they made it even more so by the decisions that they made. Let's look at the background. In verses 1 to 4, we see the details. Jacob is a shepherd who lives in Canaan. It's the same place his father Isaac lived. He has 3 wives and 12 sons. Jacob loves one of his sons, number 11, Joseph, more than any other of his sons. He's very clear, and he doesn't hide the fact that he loves Joseph more than the others. When Joseph was 17, at the start of the story, we see that he brings a bad report about his brothers to Jacob. As a result of this bad report, the brothers are unhappy, and they chose to hate Joseph, and they didn't try to hide it. They didn't try to deal with it. They didn't try to work through it. They just chose to hate him. It says they hated him so much that they couldn't even say a nice word to him. As a result of their hatred, they were blinded to the impact of their attitude. And because of their attitude, they missed the blessings and the benefits of Joseph's God-given gifts. With this family conflict as the backdrop, we see a series of events that leads to Joseph's living in Egypt. Joseph was spoken to by God through dreams. Joseph has 2 dreams that are listed here in this chapter, and the first one was set in the wheat harvest when he and his brothers were harvesting wheat. At the middle of the harvest, or in the middle of the harvest, his brother's sheaves bowed down to his sheaf. When he told this story to his brothers, it says that they hated him even more. When the second dream happened, it was very similar. This time, the sun, moon, and the 11 stars all bowed down to Joseph. When he told his family this, his father Jacob rebuked him and said, "Do you actually think we would come and bow down to you?" You see, they saw only one conclusion, that Joseph was putting himself over them, and the brothers hated him for it. They hated him even more than they had before. But in verse 10, we see that Jacob, even though he rebuked him, he never forgot about Joseph's dreams. God was trying to give the family a blessing through those dreams, but they missed it because of all of the choices that they had made. They could have experienced peace and assurance in the coming difficult times, and the knowledge that God would fulfill his promises and that he could be trusted would have helped them a lot, but they missed it. Proverbs 12:10 says that hatred stirs up conflict, but love covers all wrongs. In the next few verses, 12 to 26, we see a real-life series of events that demonstrate how hatred can turn into action. Joseph was sent by Jacob to check on his brothers who were tending sheep. We don't know why he wasn't with them already. We just know that he wasn't. Perhaps it was time away for the brothers to settle their emotions, the hatred that they felt for Joseph. But either way, Jacob sends Joseph off, and so he travels to Shechem from Hebron, which is where the brothers were supposed to be. They weren't there, so he went to Dothan, and that's where he finds him. And if the brothers were trying to settle their emotions, it did not work, because they saw him coming from a long ways away, and their immediate thought, it says, was to kill him. Why was that their thought? Well, in verse 20, it tells us that they wanted to prove that his dreams wouldn't come true, and that they would never bow down to their younger brother. While they were planning to kill him, the oldest brother, Reuben, pleaded with his brothers for Joseph's life. So when Joseph arrived, the brothers seized him, stripped him of his clothes, and threw him in a dry well called a cistern. After that, they sat down and had lunch. At that time, we see then that the betrayal of Joseph then turns into the deceit of Jacob. The brothers had to hide what they had done from him. So it started when a caravan of traders that were headed for Egypt appeared. After debating what to do among the brothers, one of the older brothers, Judah, suggested that they sell Joseph to the traders instead of killing him. We don't really know why Judah spoke up at this point, and we don't know where the older brother, Reuben, was. He seemed to have disappeared after his initial plea for Joseph's life. But the brothers decided ultimately that they could send their brother off with the traders and at the same time make a little bit of money. So they sold him for 20 shekels of silver, which, by the way, is 10 shekels less than the price of a typical slave, so it was a bargain for the traders. And as the traders went off to Egypt, the brothers turned away and went home to their father. At this point, I can't even imagine how Joseph felt as he was being taken away. It's likely that they were the same feelings that he had when they threw him into the cistern. His brothers had betrayed him. He was probably confused, frustrated, angry, scared. Here he was in a caravan headed to a new land as a slave, which is a change of status from the most favored son to slave, and it was dramatic. It must have been anguishing. It makes me wonder about Joseph. Do you think he ever asked God where he was, or, God, what are you doing? You know, God can handle those questions from Joseph, and he can handle them from us as well. God promises to show himself to us through difficult times. And Joseph's a great example for all of us when he honored God in each circumstance that he was put in. I also can't imagine how the brothers felt as they watched the caravan walk away. Maybe they felt relief. Maybe they thought that their object of their hatred was gone for good. They had news coming later on. But maybe they thought they had gotten rid of what was their biggest problem. At this point, it's interesting because Reuben re-enters the picture, and after finding out what his brothers had done, he desperately asks a great question. He says, "Where can I turn now?" The answer to you and me is that he should have turned to God. And if he'd actually stopped to think about that question, he might have done that. But he didn't. He didn't think of it. Instead, he turned to his brothers. And his brothers were not focused on God or doing right. They were focused on trying to hide what they had just done. They were trying to figure out how to tell their father what had happened without Jacob figuring out what they had done. So this is what they did. First of all, they falsified evidence to make it look like Joseph had been killed. They took the robe that Jacob had given Joseph, bathed it in blood, and took it to him. Literally, the evidence of Jacob's favoritism was thrown back in his face with blood all over it. Second, they asked a deceitful question. When they gave the robe to Jacob, they said, "See if this is your son's." Two things strike me about this comment. First, that they let their father come to his own conclusion. And second, that they didn't consider Joseph their brother. They called him, quote unquote, "your son." just shows the depth of callousness that they had for both their father and their brother. Third, they let their father mourn and they let their brother suffer instead of telling the truth. Had they told the truth, their father would have been relieved and they could have gone and rescued Joseph. He wasn't that far away. But they didn't care about any feelings but their own. And so lastly, their character continued to show when they made the appearance of trying to comfort Jacob at the very same time as they were lying to him. They must have been relieved. They must have thought their plan had worked perfectly because Joseph was gone and they thought they'd never see him again. Their father was mourning and it didn't appear that he suspected a thing. They thought they could carry on their lives, and so they did. However, the beautiful thing is in verse 36. The first word reveals what's really going on, and it starts with meanwhile. It says, meanwhile, Joseph was sold. Or in other words, God was working in the background. God was working to redeem this evil and nasty situation. He was working to redeem the actions of Joseph's brothers, and he's putting Joseph in the right place to achieve God's purposes. You see, Joseph was sold to Potiphar, and Potiphar was a ranking official in Egypt. And working for Potiphar gave Joseph the perfect situation to grow and learn, while perfectly in place for him to save Israel from the coming famine and to give them a place to grow into a nation. It demonstrates clearly that even when people betray and deceive others, God is there and he works to redeem the situation. Which leads us to our first principle this evening, that God is trustworthy to redeem even the darkest of situations for our ultimate good. I can tell you from personal experience that it's really hard to keep that perspective, especially in dark times. In 2003, I received a phone call from my wife letting me know that our 2-year-old son, Joshua, is deaf. She had just been to the doctor, and the doctor had told her that, quote unquote, we were horrible parents, and that since we found out so late in his life that he would never enter the hearing world or the deaf world, that it was too late and that it was our fault. We were shocked, and I'm telling you, we went through all kinds of emotions, as you can imagine. We knew something was different than with our other children, but we didn't have a clue that he had hearing loss, not at all. It was a really dark time for the Lackey family. And I share this with you because I know from experience that God takes things that seem really, really bad and turns them into amazingly good things. Joshua's story is a long story, and it's a story for another time. But I can tell you that God took what seemed like an end, and he turned it into a beginning. Because of Joshua's hearing loss, we moved to a different place. Because of that move, our family has been blessed tremendously. My daughters met their husbands. We met some amazing friends. We've been part of a church plant with a group of friends that have become like family to us. And I was introduced to BSF, where my relationship with Christ has grown more than I could have imagined ever. And Joshua, well, you know what? He proved the doctors wrong. He's entered both the hearing world and the deaf world. He's currently in college taking mechanical engineering, and there's more. He plays college golf. He plays guitar. And I promise you, when you meet him, which I hope you do someday, he'll read your lips so well that you won't know that he can't hear you. It's an ongoing reminder. He is an ongoing reminder and testament to God's goodness and the truth that we can trust God even when life seems to be at its darkest. So this is where Joseph is at the end of this chapter. And I'd like you to consider what area in your life God's asking you to trust him in that seems overwhelming and incredibly difficult. I want to encourage you to press into him and into his word. Stay connected to him. Remember that perseverance produces character and character produces hope. And there's hope. Our hope, it's in Jesus. At this point, we hit the pause button on the story of Joseph and we move to the story of Judah, another of Jacob's sons. After that story in Genesis 38, then we'll come back to Genesis 39 and through the end of the book, we'll see the culmination of God's plan for Israel in Egypt. Genesis 38 is the second division. In it, we'll see that God is trustworthy in brokenness. And boy, is this a story of brokenness. This story is unsavory. There's ugly stuff happening here. There's abandonment. There's betrayal. There's deceit. There's all kinds of gossip, lying, and a whole bunch more. However, in all that brokenness, there's another story that's going on. It's the story of God's trustworthiness. And we're going to see that God is trustworthy. He's always there, even when we can't see him. Working through the choices that we make, working through the situations that we put ourselves in, and keeping his promises to achieve his purposes. This story of Judah's family happens about the same time as Joseph was sold into slavery. The story is included because God's going to bless Judah with, quote-unquote, an everlasting throne. In fact, at the end of Jacob's life, he promises Judah that, quote, the scepter will not depart from him. That's in Genesis 49, 8 to 12. It's a promise that was fulfilled in David and ultimately, eternally, in Jesus Christ. But right here and right now, in this chapter, Judah is a broken man with a broken family. He might not know it yet, but he's about to find out. God continued to work behind the scenes to keep Judah's line intact, even when Judah's choices jeopardized it. Even more, God showed his love for Judah by using the circumstances, the choices that Judah made to bring Judah to a place of repentance. Let's take a look. The story starts when Judah moved away from home to live by his Canaanite friends in verse 1. We're not sure why, but we do know that he moved away from his family's influence and into the influence of Hira the Canaanite. Hira might have been his friend, but he wasn't a good influence. In verses 2 to 5, Judah marries a Canaanite woman. Makes sense, right? You live with the Canaanites, become one of them, marry one of them. He married Shua and had three sons named Onan, and Shelah. Why did Judah decide to marry outside of Abraham's family? I'm sure that growing up as a kid, he knew the promises that God had given Abraham. They had to have been taught him when he was young. We don't know for sure why he married a Canaanite woman, but we can speculate that he may have just felt at home with them, and he didn't see any harm in marrying one of them. But Judah wasn't a Canaanite. He was part of Abraham's family, God's chosen seed, and God was not ready to let Judah go. When Judah's first son, was old enough, Judah found him a Canaanite wife named Tamar. We don't know for sure why he chose Tamar, a Canaanite, but it was probably Judah doing for his son what he had done for himself. Regardless of Judah's reason, we see God's invisible hand protecting the line of Judah. You see, Tamar would be the one who would fight to preserve the family even when Judah didn't. Coming back to the present, the current situation, we see that was wicked. That's all we're told, and that God put him to death. Then Judah gave Tamar to Onan, his second son. Why did he do this? Well, Levirate custom was the rule of the day, and it dictated that to preserve a family line, the nearest living relative was required to have sexual contact with the deceased man's widow and then name the child for the deceased. The child would legally be considered the son of the deceased. But Onan wasn't God's man either. He selfishly wanted his offspring to be heirs of the family fortune, so he refused to give Tamar a son. God saw this wickedness by Onan, and he put him to death just like his older brother We see that in verse 10. Now, according to the same Levirate law, Judah was required to give Tamar to his third son, Shelah. But Shelah wasn't old enough, so Judah had to make a decision, and it's a decision we're going to look at a little closer in a couple minutes. But first, let's look at this situation. It's clear that this family was broken. Broken by the repeated sins of Judah, sins that he passed on to his sons. But I don't think Judah realized it yet. Do you think it even crossed his mind to cry out to God when his sons were dying? I'm guessing not. Have you ever been in a difficult circumstance and wondered where God was? Where was God in this circumstance? Well, we know that he was there all along. He was there for Judah, and he'll be there for you, working in the background. His bigger plans for Judah could not be thwarted by Judah's actions and the brokenness of his family. On the contrary, God was using Judah's choices, the same choices that broke his family, to move Judah back to him. Judah wasn't there yet, so it's good that there's more to the story and we get to talk about it. In verses 11 to 30, God demonstrates that he's trustworthy to keep his promises, even when his people make bad choices. As I mentioned a minute ago, Judah's choice concerning his son needed to be made, his last living son, Shelah. His obligation was to give Tamar a son through Shelah, a son that would be the heir to Judah's family and propagate the line. But and Onan, his other two sons, had died while married to Tamar, and he was concerned that the same thing might happen to Shelah. Do you think this was difficult for Judah? Have you ever been in a situation where you had to choose between an action that had an uncertain result, but maybe was the right thing to do or an action that you could control? How did you make that decision? Did you make it through prayer and trust in God? Or did you make it in your own strengths, through your own devices? In Judah's case, he made his choice on his own. He chose to protect his family line through his last son, Shelah, in his own strength. So let's take a look at the situation. The major characters as the story progresses are Judah and Tamar. God is the major player in the story, but we only see his action, not him. Here's what happened. As mentioned earlier, Judah's decision was to protect his son, so he sent Tamar away with a promise that he would give her Shelah when he grew up. But he left her waiting for a son through Shelah. It even appears that he forgot about her. It seems that he felt that with Tamar out of the way, his problem was solved, that his line could continue through Shelah. However, the invisible God, the one who promised an everlasting kingdom to Abraham, the one who had chosen Judah's family line to fulfill that promise, had not forgotten. He did not forget Judah, and he did not forget Tamar. You see, this Canaanite woman also had a choice. She had a choice to give up or fight for what was right. Even without being seen, God had caused Judah to choose Tamar. She was a fighter who would fight for what was right. And God put her in the right place to protect the line of Judah. So as Tamar waited, we don't see that she felt sorry for herself or complained. Instead, she had a group of friends, a community of people who were helping her. In verse 13, it says that Tamar was told, quote unquote, of Judah's plans. And when she realized that Judah was not going to give her to Shelah to have a son, she took action. She knew the people, Judah and Hira. She knew the situation. It was the shepherding culture, and it was a sheep shearing time of year. So she put a plan together to achieve her goal, which was to have a son by Judah's family. Then she executed the plan, and she did it flawlessly. First, she chose to disguise herself in a way that Judah could not identify her. Then she chose the right place, the road to Timnah, where Judah would be traveling. Then she positioned herself on that road at the right time to make her appear to be a shrine prostitute. At sheep shearing season, Judah would be feeling good with his friends, and so she knew that was the right time and place. When Judah wanted to pay her, she chose the right form of payment. Judah wanted to give her a goat, and while that was valuable, it wasn't what she needed. She wanted something else. She wanted evidence that Judah was the father of her children. So she asked for his seal and cord. These are his identification pieces, very similar to our driver's licenses or passports today. They were undeniable proof that it was him. After the plan was complete, she went back to living as a widow, and it worked because Judah, after attempting to pay the quote-unquote shrine prostitute and couldn't find her, he just dismissed the situation and the thought and suspected nothing else. But even though God wasn't visible in this story, we can still see him because he gave Tamar children from Judah, sons, twins. Tamar had successfully gained what was rightfully hers, sons from the line of Judah that would inherit his possessions. God used her choices to further the line of Judah. She was counted as a heroine in Israel's history because she saw the bigger picture. Even when Judah didn't, he just wanted sex. She wanted what was rightfully hers, sons. She risked her life for it, for the right to become a mother in Israel. And yes, her act was deceptive, but it was courageous. And in Ruth 4 and in Matthew 1, the Bible speaks favorably of her. God had preserved Judah's line, but as we talked about earlier, that's not all God was doing. He was also working to bring Judah back to him. But Judah still doesn't know what God's doing. Judah can't see it because he's focused on himself, just like we get. We can see this in his reactions during the rest of the story. He was so concerned about appearances and how he looked to the people around him that when he found out that Tamar was pregnant, he ordered that she be burned to death. And even though that he had shunned her for many years, he publicly reacted. There was no grace. There was no mercy. There was no inquiry into the situation. But unlike Judah, Tamar took a more private path. She confronted Judah with the evidence of his part in the pregnancy in private. And this confrontation, this is beautiful because it was Judah's defining moment. At this point, he had to choose to define or confess. And he chose to confess because he realized that his choices were bad and that Tamar's choices were better. When Judah chose to proclaim Tamar more righteous than himself, he recognized that he had treated her unfairly, that he had neglected his responsibilities, and that he had not acted in the best interest of his family. His story is a beautiful example of God's redemptive work in our lives. The word redemption came from an economic term that was used in ancient Eastern world where slaves were bought and sold. In this sense, it's used to describe how Jesus has paid the price with his blood to buy us in the marketplace of sin. It refers to a transaction, the most significant transaction of our lives, that takes place to gain possession. Our sin created a debt that we can't pay. And because of his great love, God wanted a relationship with us so badly that he sent Jesus to pay that price for our sin and to redeem us. That's redemption. Judah's choices were selfish and put him and his family line at risk. But God didn't give up on him. Instead, God used Judah's choices to bring him to a defining moment, a moment where Judah realized what he had done and what he had been doing, and his heart changed. At that moment, we see the impact of God's redemptive work in Judah's life. He realized that his past sins didn't define his future. In fact, in the future, we see a changed man going forward. He didn't have any further relations with Tamar. He grew into a strong, compassionate leader, and he looked out for his father's feelings later in life. And he offered himself later also in his brother's place later on in Genesis. And each of these circumstances and these reactions demonstrate his changed heart. It's great that God gives us this opportunity, and I just want to ask, do you struggle with a painful past? Are there things that you've done that have inflicted pain on you or your loved ones? What are the beliefs that are keeping you chained to the past? Because I got good news. I got great news. God promises a hope and a future for those that he redeems. Jesus took on the debt and guilt of our past so that we can live freely and fully for him today. Do you know someone who needs the hope of redemption? Who are they? What does God want you to say to them? Why don't you go call them if you can? In the last three verses of chapter 28, we see the story of the birth of Tamar's sons. It's a story that reminds us of the story of Jacob and Esau, where Jacob took the birthright from Esau. And we see Perez fight to become the firstborn. His birth marked the end of Tamar's struggle for an heir that would become part of Jesus' genealogy. God had redeemed Judah's actions and fulfilled his promise to Abraham. The second principle tonight is that God is trustworthy to redeem our brokenness for good. You know, in my family, there were a lot of hard times after that doctor's appointment, as I mentioned earlier. There were many times when we took our eyes off Jesus and made our own choices. Many of these choices caused pain and difficult circumstances. But the beautiful thing is that God used those circumstances to teach us that he is trustworthy and that he'll make us more like Jesus through those circumstances. We've all made choices in life, and hopefully your choices were all done with prayer and in alignment with God's will. However, if you're like me, you may have made some choices that aren't so great, and I want to encourage you to remember some things. I want you to remember that God loves you so much that he sent his son so that when you make bad choices, you can be forgiven. God loves you so much that he uses the choices you make to bring you closer to him and to mold your character, just like he did with Judah. And he loves you so much that he gives you a blueprint for how to handle failures. That blueprint is to repent, to ask forgiveness, change, and make restitution. It wasn't too late for Judah. It's not too late for you. It's not too late for me. God took many years to change Judah's hearts. He's patient. So, out of control? I don't think so. The world might seem like it's out of control when we take our eyes off God, but our God has never lost control, not even one time. He is trustworthy, and he is accomplishing his good and redemptive purposes every day.